Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity who are living on the planet Earth, listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Wednesday on this 23rd day of March, 2016. And I'm so delighted to finally have on my program for the very first time, Mark Crutcher. I consider Mark a modern day hero. I believe he may be embarrassed by hearing me say that, but his organization, Life Dynamics, is a vital organization in this day and age in which we live, where the infanticide through abortion is taking place in absolutely mind-boggling numbers, and it seems that the citizens of this land yawn with apathy in light of these grotesque crimes that are taking place, even in our debates over the presidency of the United States of America during the primaries, even in the Republican primaries, this seems to be a matter of lesser importance. But Mark Crutcher, the president of Life Dynamics and the producer of the pro-life documentary MAFA 21, is going to be on for the first hour discussing abortion, black genocide in the 21st century. And our second guest is a mutual friend of Mark and mine, Dr. Clenard H. Childress. He has been on my program a number of times. He is the founder of blackgenocide.org. He is an African-American pro-life activist, and he is going to be discussing why are black leaders silent about the slaughter of unborn black children. That will be the second hour of our broadcast. But let me, first of all, welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Mark Crutcher.
Thank you, sir. It's my pleasure to be with you.
And let me introduce you on air to my co-host today, Reverend Buzz Taylor.
Hello. Good to meet you, Mark.
Nice to meet you, sir. My pleasure to be here.
And let's hear a description of Life Dynamics. What is Life Dynamics all about, and when did it start?
Well, Life Dynamics is a pro-life organization. I started it in 1992. I'd been involved in the pro-life movement for many years at that time, but I started Life Dynamics, like I said, in 1992. And our mission was to look around the pro-life movement and identify places where we thought there were holes that needed to be filled, holes in the effort. We try not to do things that other pro-life groups are doing, and because obviously, they're doing them, and so we try to look for the things that are not being done. And we've developed over the years, as a result of doing that, a reputation for not only being very professional, but also being very innovative in the way we approach the battle over abortion.
Well, you have produced a documentary called MAFA 21, Black Genocide in the 21st Century. If you could explain the title of that documentary to our listeners.
Yeah, Maafa is a Swahili word that's used to describe the time of that Africans were enslaved, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. And it basically means a time of tragedy or a time of grief. And we thought, given the theme of our documentary, that we needed to point out that although most people think the Maafa ended when slavery ended, the reality is it didn't end then, and it continues to this day. And so that's where we came up with the name Alpha 21, 21 being for the 21st century.
And I want to let our listeners know that you can actually view the entire documentary for free on the internet if you go to maafa21.com. That's M as in Michael, A-A, F as in Frank, A, 21.com. And hopefully we'll be repeating that throughout the broadcast. This is a must-see documentary. As I was sharing with Mark before the broadcast started, I have probably seen Maafa 21 about 21 times. And I have shared the DVDs with many people, especially pastors, and even more especially with African-American pastors, with some mixed responses to that. And now I am sharing the link on the website, on the internet, very freely and frequently because of the fact that you can now watch the entire documentary right off of maafa21.com. It is sad to say, it was interesting, Mark, when I gave the DVD to an African-American brother about 3 years ago, who actually was a convert from, he had been involved in a number of things. He had been involved in Islam. He had been involved in the Nation of Islam. He had been involved in the Five Percenters. And a number of militant black racist organizations, but became a Christian, is on fire for Christ. I gave him the DVD. He was blown away by it. And I said, please show it to your pastor. And he said, my pastor isn't ready for this. And I said, well, if you think your pastor's not ready for this, he needs to see this more than ever then. And I mean, this is like the best kept secret, it seems, on the planet. Why don't we go back I want to get some brief history here before I go into some accusations made against Maafa 21 by an African-American journalist, Amani Gandhi, who wrote an article basically accusing pro-life activists of slandering Margaret Sanger. And in fact, of course, she, in typical pro-death or pro-abortionist fashion, labels us anti-choice. But before I even do that, let our listeners know, some of them may be startled, some of our listeners may have already heard this, but let our listeners know, what was the genesis of Maafa 21 in regard to Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry in the United States?
Well, you have to understand the whole history of the issue first. And the issue was, I've been involved in the pro-life movement about 35 years, and I always knew that the argument that the pro-aborts put out there, that this was done as an instrument of women's rights or women's liberation or women's freedom or reproductive freedom or whatever term they wanted to attribute to it, I always knew that was nonsense. The reality is that abortion was legalized as an instrument of eugenics and racial purity. And we decided to do a documentary on that. And this thing evolved over a period of 3 years. It took us 3 years to do all the research and to write the script for it. And it kept on changing because we kept on getting new information. But what we did was we started with the current day. We started backwards. We started working from current times and looking backwards at how things happened in the pro-life movement. In other words, one thing led to the next, and that thing led to this, and this thing led to that. And when we did that, what we found out was that we initially thought, well, it would end probably in the mid-1960s. You have to understand something. The first thing that we picked up on, and this is what started us on this process of working backwards, was that if you go back and look at the early days of what now is known as the pro-life movement, everybody thinks it started in the early 1970s with the passage of Roe versus Wade, and that it was basically an instrument of, sometimes they think it's an instrument of the Catholic Church or evangelicals or primarily white conservative Republicans. The reality is, the first pro-life groups in this country were Black Panthers, Elijah Muhammad's organization, the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
These were actually the first anti-abortion groups in America.
Yeah.
And when we saw that, I mean, we stumbled across that information and all the quotes from them and all the stuff that they had written and put out at that time. It was kind of startling. And so we quickly saw that the going backwards in this thing was not going to end it in the 1960s or even in the late 1950s, which we thought was as far back as it would possibly go. When we kept on going backwards in this one thing leads to another mindset, we eventually got back to the days prior to the end of slavery. And that's pretty much where the trail ended. And what we discovered was that in the years leading up to the end of slavery in America, the people that had created the slave trade and had profited from it, made their fortunes off of it, began to see that the world was rejecting slavery and that it was only a matter of time before the United States would reject it by some manner or another. It might be through a Supreme Court decision, or it might be through laws passed, or it might be through, it eventually turned out, a war. But they knew that it was going to come to an end at some point. And what they began to worry about was, what was this going to do to the economy of the United States when you suddenly released millions of people into the economy who you had kept artificially poor and artificially uneducated and basically unemployable anywhere but the cotton patch? What's going to happen to the economy when you release these people into the public? And their initial response to this was a process called colonization, where they were going to basically round up all the slaves and send them back to Africa. There were a lot of logistical problems with that. You couldn't put millions of slaves on ships. And what if they didn't want to go? What were you going to do? Were you going to recapture them
right.
They were in Africa? And the biggest problem they had, though, was that by the time the idea of colonization came along, most of the people that in this country that were enslaved had been born here. So they'd never been to Africa. So you're not going to be sending them back to a country they'd never been to. So there were a lot of problems with it, even though it was a very large endeavor. It was actually funded by the United States Congress. The United States Congress allocated money for the relocation of Africans back to Africa. But it failed. It didn't work. And the interesting thing was that about the time colonization failed, there was a new philosophy coming along in America, being advanced by a man named Francis Galton.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called eugenics. And he actually made up the word eugenics. And his theories about eugenics and about the superiority of white people or Caucasian people was actually advanced by his cousin, a man named Charles Darwin. And most people have never studied Darwin, don't realize that he was an avowed racist. And he was the one who advanced this strategy along with his cousin Francis Galton about eugenics. And what eugenics, what their theory was, is that if you looked at human life in its continuum, what they thought was, or what they advanced was, and still do to this day, that it starts with the lowest form of primate and advances up through the primates until it gets to the human form. And they said that the highest form of primate was the gorilla, and the lowest form of human was the aborigine or the African. And that basically there was very, very little distinction between a gorilla and an African, or a gorilla and an aborigine. And that the larger this gap could be made, the better the human race would be. And so you're not going to wipe out all the gorillas in the world, and you might eventually if that was your idea. But their idea was that you start by wiping out the lowest form of humans. And that was what became known as eugenics. Actually, Francis Galton, Charles Darwin's cousin, and Charles Darwin himself made up the term eugenics. It never existed anywhere in literature prior to their coming up with it. The first thing they looked at in accomplishing this, what you have to understand is that the people who had made their fortunes off the backs of slaves and had lost the idea of colonization, sending them to Africa, were really attracted to this new philosophy called eugenics. And their first strategy was that they would encourage the white race to reproduce at a much higher rate than the African race, the African Americans, and basically overwhelm them with numbers at some point. And they referred to that as positive eugenics. Positive eugenics eventually failed. They showed no benefits from it, and so they went to what's called negative eugenics. And in negative eugenics, they not only tried to make white people reproduce at a much higher rate, they tried to get black people to reproduce at a much lower rate, and that also failed. And this strategy, and this is what I'm saying, this strategy kept on going from year in and year out, and as one thing failed, another thing came along, and then another thing, and then another thing. After negative eugenics started failing, they started looking at things like sterilization. And sterilization became the new golden child for the eugenics movement. And a lot of people don't realize how widespread sterilization and eugenics boards were in the United States. But by the 1930s, over 30 states in the United States had eugenics boards and or sterilization boards. And the last one did not disband until 1984. The last one was in Oregon in 1984. So this was something that lasted for many, many decades. Along about that, when you had one of the big proponents of the idea of sterilization and eugenics was a woman named Margaret Sanger. And Margaret Sanger was basically the go-to person for all these rich eugenicists. We're talking about the Carnegies and Rockefellers and so forth that had made millions and millions of dollars. And they were the proponents of eugenics, but they weren't going to be the ones who actually carried it out. And basically, she was the person she and people like her were the ones they basically hired to carry out eugenics. And she started an organization called the American Birth Control League. And they were pushing birth control, particularly onto the minority community, which they widely wrote about, pushing on the minority community. By the 1940s, though, eugenics and population control had become kind of problematic for these people because it took on such a negative image when the Nazis came into existence. And so in 1943, as a public relations move, the American Birth Control League changed its name to Planned Parenthood. But they pursued the same policy. The same people were in charge. The same eugenics people were in charge. The first president, of course, was a man named Alan Guttmacher, or one of the first presidents. He was also vice president of the American Eugenics Society. Margaret Sanger herself was a member. They put on all kinds of conferences. They were very closely aligned, and we show the documentation for that in the documentary, with the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler even referred to some of the programs in the United States to reduce the population of what they called dysgenic groups as his model for the concentration camps. One of the people that, the first concentration camps, everybody thinks about them being in Germany or in Europe. The first ones that the Nazis put in place were in Africa. And they were run by a man named Eugen Fischer. And Margaret Sanger put on conferences in which one of the people she invited to speak was Eugen Fischer. He was the man who actually designed the concentration camp system in Africa that was eventually replicated in Nazi-occupied Europe. As time went on, and again, this goes back to this thing of going from one subject to the next and seeing how one thing links to the other. And believe me, as you know from having watched Moffitt 21, I'm just giving you the thumbnail sketch.
Yes.
We document all this fully and in detail in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, as time went on, they had come to rely almost exclusively on the idea of sterilization to carry out their eugenics goals. Over 200,000 people were eventually sterilized, many of them forcibly sterilized in the United States by these state eugenics boards and state sterilization boards. Very often they were run in cahoots with Planned Parenthood. I'll just give you one example. In Arkansas, the state director, a state office for Planned Parenthood, was the state office for the American Eugenics Society and the state office for the Arkansas Eugenics Board. So these were very often one and the same organizations. The problem that they started having, though, in the late 50s and early 60s, there started to be court rulings that sterilization boards were unconstitutional. And it became obvious to them that it was only a matter of time till you started having, even on the federal level, probably through the Supreme Court, prohibitions against these eugenic boards. And they started being shut down. Like I said, the last one existed up until 1984 in Oregon. When they started losing the battle for eugenics through sterilization is when they then turned their sights on eugenics through birth control and abortion. And this is what the early civil rights leaders in this country clearly saw. And you can go back and look at people like Eldridge Cleaver and Stokely Carmichael, who at the time were regarded as radical civil rights, you know, bomb throwers, basically. All these people openly stated, you can go see their writings, you can hear their speeches sometimes on YouTube, that birth control and abortion were going to become instruments to wipe out the black community. Even Jesse Jackson made statements like that back in those days. He was adamantly pro-life, called for the banning of abortion long before it became legal through Roe versus Wade. Because he pointed out, he said, I find it very interesting that at the very moment when people of color start achieving some real power and status in the country, all of a sudden, there's these great hue and cry calls for the legalization of abortion. So they saw all of this coming. And that's what, where you go back and read this stuff. The Black Panthers especially were pretty hardcore, adamantly pro-life, opposed to the legalization of abortion. And so that was why I said earlier that the real pro-life, the initial pro-life groups in this country wasn't American Life League or National Right to Life or any of the other, or Life Dynamics or any of the other pro-life groups that you think of today. It was these people. It was the radical 60s civil rights leaders who now turn out to not have been so radical after all.
Right.
And actually turned out to be quite right on these things. And so we just kept on studying this, going, like I say, from step to step to step, and eventually our strategy was that we were going to show in MAHAFA 21 a connect-the-dots, step-by-step story of how slavery morphed into the legalization of abortion. It was designed to get rid of the African-American community that these people who had made billions of dollars off of never saw no more use for. They wanted rid of them. They were worried what they were going to do to the economy.
Yeah, I'm a native Long Islander. Before moving to Pennsylvania, I lived on Long Island all my life, and one of my favorite places to treat my late wife to dinner was in Cold Spring Harbor, Long Island. And Cold Spring Harbor, a lot of people who live on Long Island may be shocked to hear, was a main hub or headquarters of this racist ideology known as eugenics.
Still is.
Really?
Still there.
Well, I know that the lab is still a bit there, but is the eugenics aspect of it still a part of it?
Yes.
Really? Well, that's interesting. See, I just learned something. Something
you,
even
you
more.
You just learned something. I'm trying to figure out how I could be almost 60 and never heard any of this.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's why I said it's the best kept secret, it seems.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go into some of the accusations by Imani Gandhi, and she is no relation to Mahatma Gandhi. It's spelled differently. G-A-N-D-Y. She is an African-American journalist and author, and she had an article that came out last August, How False Narratives of Margaret Sanger Are Being Used to Shame Black Women. And the subtitle of this article is Anti-Choicers Wield Misattributed and Often Outright False Quotes About Sanger as Weapons to Shame Black Women for Exercising Their Right to Choose, and even more nonsensically, to shame them for supporting Planned Parenthood. And she has, let's see here, she has this this quote here, or actually this statement. Sanger was pro-birth control and anti-abortion. This may surprise you, considering that Planned Parenthood opponents frequently accuse Sanger of erecting abortion clinics in black neighborhoods, a practice they claim the organization continues to this day. But this is simply not true. Sanger opposed abortion. She believed it to be a barbaric practice, in her own words. Although abortion may be resorted to in order to save the life of the mother, the practice of it merely for limitation of offspring is dangerous and vicious. Her views are ironically in keeping with the views of many of the anti-choicers who malign and distort her legacy. If you could comment on that.
Well, first off, let's make sure we understand something. The people like this woman you're talking about are not, we're not the target of our educational video.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing on God's green earth that you can say to someone like that
mm-hmm.
that's going to change their mind. Nothing. She's also set up a straw man argument here. When she says that the pro-life movement accuses Margaret Sanger of setting up abortion clinics in black communities and that this practice continues to this day, she's lying. No one in the pro-life movement has ever said that I'm aware of, or we certainly didn't say, that Margaret Sanger set up birth control clinics in black communities. That's what Planned Parenthood does today. But Margaret Sanger died before abortion was legal. So we're not, no one is saying that she did this. And yes, she made some anti-abortion statements at the time, but so did most of the people at Planned Parenthood, because at that time, their thrust was sterilization. They were not pushing for abortion because they knew that from a public relations standpoint, if you're talking about the 1940s, the 1950s, and even up until the mid-1960s, if you push for legalization of abortion, you're not going to get any public support at all. And so you had a lot of people that were contemporaries of Margaret Sanger's in the eugenics movement, and she was a member of the American Eugenics Society. You had a lot of people in that movement who would make these public statements against abortion, and they may, some of them may honestly believe it. What you saw is that when they started losing access to sterilization as their instrument of eugenics, all of a sudden their minds started changing. And, of course, I used the example earlier of Jesse Jackson. When Jesse Jackson decided, and this let me back up, this is literally true. One week, Jesse Jackson is saying that abortion is an instrument of black genocide and is the wholesale slaughter of living human beings, and that it has to be stopped and prohibited by the U.S. Constitution. One week he's saying that, and a week later he's saying the right to abortion is the civil rights struggle of our time, and he's totally 100% supportive of abortion and is to this day. But he did that for political reasons. He decided he wanted to run for president, and he was going to run as a Democrat, and the Democratic Party, by this point, had become completely sold out to the pro-eugenics, pro-abortion crowd, and Jesse Jackson knew full well he would never get any financial support or any political support for his desire to be president unless he switched, so he did. And that's not unlike many of these eugenics people who might have, in an earlier time, said negative things about abortion, but when the politics of it favored abortion, they suddenly changed their mind.
I'm going to be going to a break in a second, but before I go to the break, I wanted to read another quote from Imani Gandhi's article. that you could respond to when we return. She says, it is simply untrue that Margaret Sanger wanted to exterminate the black race. This is a flat-out lie, yet it is one that is repeated ad nauseum by both anti-choice activists and the politicians who support them, most recently Ben Carson. And if you could respond to that when we return from the break, and if you'd like to join us on the air with questions of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Don't go away. We're going to be right back with Mark Crutcher and Abortion, Black Genocide in the 21st Century.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Tired of box store Christianity? Of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
Finances and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you've just tuned us in, our guest for the first hour has been Mark Crutcher, president of Life Dynamics and producer of Ma'afa 21, Black Genocide in the 21st Century. And we have been discussing not only the genocide that is taking place in America of black unborn children, in addition to children of all races, but we also have been responding to an article by Imani Gandhi, which I hope to get Imani Gandhi on my program at some point to have a debate with someone, either Mr. Crutcher or someone from Life Dynamics or perhaps even Dr. Childress, but so that is something that I would like to do at some point. But if you could reply to the comment that I made before the break about this journalist defending Margaret Sanger as not having any desire to exterminate the black race.
If you go, all I can tell people is, first off, we have a website called ProLifeAmerica.com, and on there you can see that we have all of Margaret Sanger's writings. We have copies of all her books. You can research them there. We also have copies of every birth control review. That was the newsletter for the American Birth Control League and later Planned Parenthood. And we have copies of all 100% of the birth control reviews on there, and she was the editor of the birth control review. And I would just challenge anyone to go read her own words for themselves. She was very, you have to remember they used code words. They didn't necessarily, and they didn't always say, although there are places in there where this was pretty overt, but they didn't always say, we're here to wipe out blacks. But they would use code words like the feeble-minded. So they would in one place talk about how feeble-mindedness was a justification for eugenics, and then another place talk about how many more people were feeble-minded among the so-called dysgenic groups than in other groups. So if you combine those, obviously what you're saying is we've got to get rid of these dysgenic peoples. And I would also point out that in her own autobiography, which we have a copy of that anyone can read and research on that website, she was a speaker at a Planned Parenthood rally in Silver Lake, New Jersey. And if she talks in there, she brags in there about how she found them to be a very interesting group, and that how after their speech, she was approached by the leaders of 10 other Klan groups who wanted her to come speak to them.
I think it may have slipped by there very quickly. She spoke at a Ku Klux Klan rally.
At a Ku Klux Klan rally,
right,
in Silver Lake, New Jersey. Now, it strains credulity to believe that they would have her back if she was saying things that they didn't totally want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
That they would have 10 or 12 other groups invite her to come back and speak. You know, and another thing, speaking of Silver Lake, New Jersey, something you mentioned earlier about Cold Spring Harbor being in New York. One of the things that we discovered as we were doing this research, because once we got backwards past the issue of sterilization and started getting into the era of slavery, one of the things we discovered was that, although the practice of slavery was predominant in the South, because the South was the agrarian part of the country where slavery was an economic institution and it was more viable in the South than it would be in the North, so that's where it was mostly practiced. The actual financial hub of slavery was New York City. And so it doesn't come as a big shock when you start hearing things about, for example, Margaret Sanger speaking to a Klan rally. If I said that to people, they'd think, well, that must have been in Georgia or Alabama or Mississippi or Texas or somewhere. No, this was in Silver Lake, New Jersey. And so this idea that this was just a regional problem is nonsense. It was very much a national problem. And the whole country was mixed up in this. The South was the one who was taking advantage of it from the standpoint of actually using slaves. But the financial hub of it was in the North, in New York City.
By the way, I want to be fair to Imani Gandhi that she does not scour Margaret Sanger's reputation sparkly clean in regard to some unfortunate allies that she had. But I think that she still is either intentionally or through being misguided and ignorant of the facts, is whitewashing, for lack of a better term, no pun intended, her history. And here's another thing that she says. Anti-choice zealots tell us that Margaret Sanger was the American version of Hitler, proposing a final solution to the black question. This is nonsense. And she later says, in fact, the Nazis were not fans of Sanger. They even burned her books. As Gerald V. O'Brien points out in his article, Margaret Sanger and the Nazis, how many degrees of separation? Moreover, as Amita Kelly writes for NPR recently pointed out, Sanger herself wrote in 1939 that she had joined the anti-Nazi committee and gave money, my name, and any influence I had with writers and others to combat Hitler's rise to power in Germany. Well, obviously that was very convenient when the Nazis were, being more realized as being an enemy of our country than previously. But if you could respond to that.
Well, sure. Again, it would have been very easy by the late 1930s to be anti-Nazi, but you still have to go back and look at the origin of this stuff. And you can clearly see that the eugenics, even the Nazis made this point, that the eugenics strategies that they were putting in place to take out the Jews, and by the way, they started with blacks. They didn't start out with Jews originally, in Germany. But the strategies that they used were totally derived from the American eugenics movement. And their idea even for concentration camps. There was a proposal in Indiana to have concentration camps in Indiana for what they call feeble-minded people. By the way, and quite conveniently, they turned out to be mostly black. And just like when they did with sterilization, the sterilization was meant to take out the feeble-minded, and almost 100% of the people that were forcibly sterilized were blacks and African-Americans. So by the late 1930s, certainly if you're in America and you're wanting to survive and you're wanting to get donations and you're wanting to get even whatever government help you can get, you're going to have to be an opponent of the Nazis, but you're still going to have to go back and explain how she had all these alliances with all of these people that were Nazis. For example, again, I'll bring up the point of Eugen Fischer. Why would she have a man like this who was already very well known for having started the concentration camps that the Germans opened up in Africa? Why would she have him there? Mm-hmm. Why would she do all the other things that she did? And again, I'm imploring people, don't take my word for it, and certainly don't take this woman's word for it that's trying to defend her. Go read her own work. Go read their materials that we have online. It'll take you a while. It's a lot of material. They put out a voluminous amount of stuff, but make up your own mind what they were doing.
Yeah, there wasn't there a scientist who was in the Third Reich who wrote for her magazine or at least wrote an article or something?
There were several of them that did that. And, again, we make these documentary points in the MAFA 21 movie. And again, I think we've connected the dots perfectly. I would also challenge anyone to watch MAFA 21 and instead of just making this blanket statement that you don't believe it or it's not true or whatever, point to the stuff that's incorrect. Because we fully documented 100% of what we put in that movie. If you watch the credits at the end, I mean, the credits go on forever and ever because of all the documentation that we did for it. You know, I would challenge them to do that.
And one thing that I forgot to mention during the anti-abortion quote that Imani Gandhi or Gandhi cited from the pen of Margaret Sanger, it is true that there are many white supremacists who are anti-abortion when they are referring to white people. Like the Nazis themselves were against abortion by Aryan women, but they were very much in favor, obviously, of all kinds of grotesque practices like euthanasia and abortion and other things when it was not involving Aryan couples having children.
Well, yeah, the Hamburg Eugenics Court outlawed abortion because abortion was illegal prior to the Nazis taking over. And when the 1935 Hamburg Eugenics Court, which was partially funded, by the way, by the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations here in the United States, when that court convened to decide, when that tribunal convened to decide what their abortion policy was going to be, they continued it being illegal for Aryans, but it became mandatory for some other groups. Groups they wanted to get rid of, and it's interesting to note, and we have some documentation in the movie from that eugenics court, that some of the earliest people they went after were blacks. They were going to wipe out, get rid of all the blacks that were in Germany at the time, or in Nazi occupied Europe at that time. The reason you don't hear a lot about that is because there physically just weren't that many of them. But that was one of the initial targets.
Yes, you will very rarely, if ever, hear a white supremacist complaining about blacks or others, other minorities having abortions.
No, we found some quotes when we were doing this research from leaders and white supremacist leaders here in the United States talking about one of the smartest things they could do is to open up abortion clinics in minority neighborhoods. And that leads me to something that I was going to bring up that you had talked about earlier. When this woman is saying, we said that Margaret Sanger opened up all these abortion clinics in minority neighborhoods and continue to do this to this day, we never said Margaret Sanger did that, but Planned Parenthood is doing it. And we have another report out that you can go at ProLifeAmerica.com and read, in which we looked at, we took all the zip codes in the United States that have either a birth control clinic or an abortion clinic or a Planned Parenthood facility, and we took their zip codes, and we went to the United States Census Bureau and got an analyzation of all those zip codes by race. And what you see is that those facilities have been grossly disproportionately placed in minority neighborhoods. The result of that is that today, black women, just using blacks, not counting Hispanics, which is another issue, but black women make up only about 12% of the female population of America, but they have almost 40% of the abortions. A black baby today is five times as likely to be aborted than is a white baby.
Hmm.
And in some parts of the United States, for example, New York City, more black babies are aborted than are born. The New York City Health Department did a study on this about 3 years ago. And at that time, they found out that for every 10 pregnancies that occur to black women in New York City, six of them are aborted.
Wow.
And we're seeing that. That's the highest rate that I've seen anywhere in the country, but we're seeing similar things, or rates approaching that in other parts of the country. But the fact is that abortion is doing what the Klan could never even dream of doing.
Yeah, it's interesting how this journalist, Imani Gandhi, seems to be going out of her way to defend Sanger as being anti-abortion when it's clearly the journalist herself is pro-abortion. I mean, she is calling us anti-choicers, and she said that it is nonsensical to shame black women for supporting Planned Parenthood, who is performing more abortions than any other organization in the United States, correct?
Yes, but first off, again, you have a false premise to her statement. I know of no one who is shaming black women. I've not heard that being espoused by anybody except the opponents of this, which is very ironic when you think about it. But no one is shaming black women. Black women have been the targets and the victims of this. And no one is shaming them for that. We're not shaming them any more than we would shame women who are victims of rape or armed robbery or anything else. No one is shaming anybody here.
Now, we do have an anonymous listener from Long Island, New York, who says that a pastor who is a friend of mine and who seems biblically sound in many ways refuses to watch the Ma'afa 21 documentary because he is claiming it is nothing more than Republican propaganda. How do you respond to that? Well, it's interesting that the pastor would respond that way without having seen it. And secondly, having seen it myself, you hold Republican politicians and presidents, you hold their feet to the fire and expose them just as much as you do Democrats in this documentary.
Well, I would make the argument that the political figure that comes off the worst in that documentary,
Nixon,
Richard Nixon.
Yes,
we have quotes from him. We got the actual we didn't find them written down. We've got the actual tapes of him saying that if abortion is ever legalized, he knows for a fact that it'll be done to get rid of the blacks in America.
Mm-hmm.
He makes that statement. We've got it in there.
Yes, and pardon me for quoting him, but he actually says "little black bastards" is what he says.
Right. Well, I didn't know if you wanted to use that time.
Well, I was just quoting him. No, it wasn't my sentiment. So
he said it'll be to get rid of the black bastards. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And we quoted several other high-profile Republicans in there as being mobbed up in this thing. They're up to their eyes in it. Let me tell you something. The Republican Party is about as guilty of this as this situation as are the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
When you tell me that this black pastor says, I won't watch this because it's a slam piece on Democrats, that proves the point that I made to you a moment ago about this woman that wrote this article. There is nothing you can say or do to change these people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
So don't worry about them. Write them off. We're going after the people out there who are good, decent people who are living in deception about this issue. They believe a certain thing about abortion or about the abortion issue or about the pro-life movement or whatever they believe because they've been deceived primarily by the American media. So that's who we're going after. But as far as worrying about people like this woman here or this black pastor that you're talking about from New York, you can write them off. They're lost. You're never going to get them back.
Hmm. Well, with God, all things are possible, though.
he can get them back. I can't.
We have another anonymous listener from Long Island, New York, also, who says that in speaking with a woman who runs a crisis pregnancy center, she told me that today the trend has reversed where more white children are being aborted, not blacks. Is she getting her facts confused?
Well, I don't know because I don't know where her center is and I don't know what the demographic profile of her clients are. That might be true in her center. I don't know. I'm telling you, nationally, that's not the situation. Nationally, black women still have a vastly disproportionate number of the abortions compared to whites. A black baby is still five times more likely to be murdered in the womb than is a white baby.
And a thought occurred to me. I'm wondering if, and I'm not impugning these motives to the person that our listener is referring to, because I don't know who that person is. But I'm wondering if there are people who are very actively involved in the pro-life movement who don't want to use the documentation of Ma'afa 21 as their propaganda because they are fearing that they will get less support because of the reality of racism even amongst Christians. In other words, if it's black babies who are being aborted, maybe white evangelicals and even white Roman Catholics in mass won't be as angry and furious and willing to support and do whatever they can to stop the genocide. You follow what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying, and I have said this for years. And it's a dangerous argument, and I have talked to this pro-life groups about this as it relates to Alpha 21. It's a dangerous argument in a certain sense to go out and argue that abortion is being used to wipe out the black community because there's so much latent racism in this country that's right below the surface that no one would ever admit to. But I have seen with my own eyes personal examples of where you convince somebody of this and they kind of sit back and say, you know, that really doesn't bother me that much. And I hate to say that because it's an indictment on our country, but unfortunately that's a reality. And so, yeah, you may actually, you run the risk that you run when you make this argument, and I won't back away from it because it's a fact, it's true, so I'm not backing away from it, but the risk that you run is you actually make some people pro-abortion that might have otherwise not been. Because they look back and they say, well, heck, this thing is being used primarily by minorities, African Americans and Hispanics. I really don't have much of a problem with that. I'm fine with that. That'll keep them off the welfare rolls. And, you know, one example you can see of this is in the there's some writings out there talking about how abortion reduces the crime rate. If you remember the book Freakonomics, that was one of the arguments that the authors of that made, was that because abortion is disproportionately used in the black community, and because blacks are more disproportionately predisposed to commit crime, that a high abortion rate among blacks keeps the crime rate lower. That's the kind of subtle racism that we have to fight in this country. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
And we have another listener, Arnie in Perry County, Pennsylvania, who says that I would tend to think that white girls and women are having more abortions because in the more affluent culture, it is more of a thing to be shamed about, having a baby out of wedlock, that is, or as a young teenager, where it seems to be commonplace in the urban and poverty-stricken areas where many unmarried and young women are giving birth at high rates. How do you account for this phenomenon?
Again, the abortion industry's own statistics show just the opposite of that, that the abortion rate is much higher in the black community than it is in the white community. Now, the pregnancy rate is higher as well, so there are bigger numbers to work with. But the fact is that, again, a thing I repeated before, right now, according to the abortion industry's own figures put out by Guttmacher Institute and sometimes by the CDC, or the National Institute of Health, a black baby is now five times as likely to be murdered in the womb as a white baby is. So the argument he's making is based on his supposition or his theories or feelings. But if you look at the numbers, they don't back that up.
And I really want you to unburden your heart to leave our listeners with what you most want etched in their hearts and minds before they leave this program. I know that you could only be with us for an hour today. Perhaps in the future you could be with us for the full 2 hours. But I just want to make sure that you leave our listeners with everything that you, or as much that you can summarize, that you want them to know.
Well, basically, I want them to understand that they've been lied to. They've been lied to by the abortion industry, and they've been lied to by the media, who's in the back pocket of the abortion industry. It's one thing to say, if you want to say that abortion ought to be legal, then that's your right to say that. You want to believe that, you can believe it. But at least do it with your eyes open. Don't do it with the idea in mind that this is something that profits women. This is something that profits the eugenics movement. Don't believe for a moment that abortion was legalized in order to advance the cause of women's rights or women's liberation or women's freedom or any of that nonsense. If you want to believe that abortion should be legal, then do so, but do so on the basis of reality, not on what you've been told. And this is the reason, for example, the fact that this has enslaved women, it has not freed women, is the reason that the early feminists in this country were all pro-life. If you go back and read the writings of Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Virginia Woodhull or Susan B. Anthony or Evelyn Judge, who wrote the original Equal Rights Amendment, all of these women vehemently opposed the legalization of abortion because they said it was going to be an instrument in which sexually irresponsible men and sexually predatory men would be able to control women. And that's exactly what it's become. We've done a complete report, again, at Pro-Life America, you can read it, about the number of women in this country that are murdered because they refuse to have abortions. And it has become an instrument of sexually irresponsible and sexually predatory males using against women. So don't be deceived into thinking that this was done for their benefit. It was done as an instrument of eugenics and genocide.
Well, Mark Crutcher, thank you so much for being on the program. And I know that two of your websites are lifedynamics.com, lifedynamics.com, and to watch the entire Ma'afa 21 documentary subtitled Black Genocide in 21st Century America. The website is mafa21.com, M as in Michael, A, F as in Frank, A, the numerals 2 and 1, ma'afa21.com. You can watch the whole thing there. And you had a Pro-Life America website. What was that?
Yeah, ProLifeAmerica.com is our gateway website. If you just go to that, you get all these other websites. Every one of them is there on the front page of ProLifeAmerica.com.
All righty. Well, thank you so much, Mark, and we look forward to having you back on Iron Sharpens Iron in the near future, God willing.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.
And don't go away, because coming up right after a station break is a gentleman who has contributed to the Ma'afa 21 documentary, a friend of mine, Dr. Clennard Howard Childress. Our first guest, Mark Crutcher, was a Caucasian individual, but we have an African-American pastor, Clennard Howard Childress, who is one of the primary black pro-life activists in the United States today, and he is going to be discussing a very controversial theme, and that is, why are black leaders silent about the slaughter of unborn black children? And that basically is a appropriate sequel to our first hour with Mark Crutcher. So if you have any questions of your own, shoot us an email at chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. And please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. And please only remain anonymous if it's about a personal and private matter that you want to ask about. Don't go away. We're going to be right back with Dr. Clennard Howard Childress, Jr.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402. Or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Attention coin collectors and investors. Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, so order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at Providence Baptist Church, MA.org, that's Providence Baptist Church, MA.org, or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnzen. If you just tuned us in, the first hour of the program, we had Mark Crutcher, the president of Life Dynamics and producer of the pro-life documentary Ma'afa 21, as our guest. And as a very appropriate sequel to that interview, we now have Dr. Clennard Howard Childress, Jr., an African-American pro-life activist and founder of blackgenocide.org. Blackgenocide.org. He is going to be discussing why are black leaders silent about the slaughter of unborn black children. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you back to Iron Sharpens Iron, Dr. Clennard Howard Childress.
Thank you so much for having me again. Great to be here.
And I wanted to introduce you to my co-host, Reverend Buzz Taylor.
Hello. Good to meet you.
Okay, wonderful.
And let me, for our listeners who have not heard you before on this program or maybe unfamiliar with you, please let them know something about blackgenocide.org. If someone didn't know any better, they might think that's a white supremacist organization that you've got a website for.
Well, with these elections, certainly there's a whole lot of spin, but no, that is basically from the heart. When I learned of the disproportionate amount of African-American women having abortions, it was extremely alarming, but it was devastating to find out that it was systemic and that it was deliberate and that they were being targeted. And it was sad to find out even more so because of African-Americans' allegiance to the Democratic Party, African-American leadership chose to turn away, turn a deaf ear, ignore, put down their principles for political positions and prominence. And so, therefore, the Holocaust continues. Has it gotten better? Yes. There's voices, and both male and female, that God is getting to. Of course, I don't know if it could ever be fast enough for me, but it is, I would have to say, stepping back and looking at it, it is becoming increasingly better for awareness, but we still have a ways to go.
And let us know about LEARN, L-E-A-R-N. My program, coincidentally, is on a network in Texas called L-E-R-N, LEARN, which is the leading edge radio network, but you have a different LEARN organization that you are a part of.
Yes, it's the Life Education and Resource Network. It's the largest African-American network of pro-life activists, and it was founded by the Reverend Dr. Johnny Hunter, Hayward Henderson there in Texas, Dr. Henderson in Texas, and I'm probably going to get in trouble now. I can't remember the two other founders.
No, that's quite all right.
But they began it, I'd say, in early of 93, somewhere around in there. And I got an invitation to attend in 1995, 96, at the Virginia Beach, basically headquarters for a 700 Club, the campus there. And to be quite honest, I had always been a fan of Ben Kenchelow and Pat Robinson. And I was going there since they were, they said they would pay for the trip down there if I would go. I said they didn't have to ask twice. And there I saw Akula Farrow, who was one of the original founders also, and she did a presentation on the Negro Project, which basically documented the agenda of Margaret Sanger, the founding mother, so to speak, of Planned Parenthood. You have to understand I'm a young African-American preacher who felt he was aware of the issues in the black community. It was, for me and my wife, it was a life-changing experience hearing the link of the Birth Control League to Planned Parenthood, one of the same, and basically continuing the same eugenic agenda that they had when they were the Birth Control League, and the players remained the same, the people remained the same, and the agenda remained the same,
and the derogatory statements that Margaret Sanger made about Klan about African Americans, while even the president and founder and voice for the organization was just staggering to me. And so we left there saying we had to do more, and one thing just led to another. And my good friend Arnold Colbert, who's also a pro-life activist, he made the comment that you don't choose pro-life advocacy. Pro-life advocacy chooses you. And I said, that couldn't have been said any better.
Now, before this awakening, if you will, were you pro-choice, or were you just not as enthusiastically involved in the pro-life movement?
That's with the latter. Okay. I just wasn't physically involved. I knew it was wrong. As I often say, today we can empirically prove, more or less, the nation, basically, in 1973 it was, the judges, more or less, the final analysis was, we don't know when life begins, as you know. And then came, I think it was Doe versus Bolton or something along that line, and then you could have an abortion through all 9 months. Well, I knew abortion was going on. I never knew the numbers. But to think that a child could be aborted all the way up to 9 months by the law, I had no idea. It was staggering. And so now science has caught up with conscience. We always knew it was a baby, but now we can scientifically prove that life begins at conception. But yet the slaughtering continues. And so we just found ourselves being, our time being used more and more in life advocacy for the segment of our community that has been cut off from the American dream.
So you, as an African-American man, would obviously, from what you said, you'd vehemently disagree with a journalist, the journalist that we were quoting from in the first hour, Imani Gandhi, African-American female journalist, who says that the accusations of racism against Margaret Sanger are grossly exaggerated, if not flat-out lies, by the anti-choicers, as she calls us.
Well, that's very sad that they had to coerce her and probably rewarded her graciously and lucratively for her comments. Anybody with any cursory search at all can clearly see, and these are not words that we said she said. These are her own writings. And so the best thing that a mother can do for a child where there's children already present, something along that line, would be to kill it. That's a woman saying that in the 30s. Uh-huh. And so we find that is just one of many. Colored people are like human weeds. They need to be controlled. The derogatory, dehumanizing comments were as racist as one could get. Now, she had issues. If you read her story, you find that her mother died giving birth and already had, six children or five children. And she never was the same after that. And so she came unquestionably to actually detest women who would have more than two children. And if it was left up to her, they would probably have just one. She was way ahead of China long before now. But the writer would never debate Reverend Childers. You can call her a million times. She would never be on the same form with me. I challenge at the NAACP, at the Congressional Black Caucus. We have challenged them to an open forum. We are censored. We are barred. And your listeners need to know this. I'm not making this up. And what I do sometimes, I said, and I had a local program here in the Bronx, he says, well, I'm going to get them to come down and have a debate. I said, well, I can tell you right now, they won't answer you. They won't adhere to that, but you try. And she scoffed at me. She said, well, why wouldn't they? They're community leaders just like you. They're interested in the black community just like you. They're interested in women's health just like you. I said, ma'am, I've been doing this a while. They will not come on this program. And sure enough, she called four of them. One said yes, and the one that said yes canceled the week before. They would not come on and debate, because if you get in the form of a debate, you lose. You don't want to take on debate, you know you're going to lose.
Yeah.
And they're about not women's health, but marketing their ideology. And if abortion was not lucrative, it would not be legal. They're benefiting from the death, the disproportionate deaths of African Americans and babies in general.
Now, we were discussing with Mark Crutcher, your friend and colleague, in the first hour, how universally it seemed those that were leaders of the civil rights movement, or those who were even involved in extremist groups led by black leaders that even you and I would feel very uncomfortable with today, if not outright opposed for many reasons, some of which may have even had a black racism against the white race and so on, but it was universally, it seems, understood that black leaders and activists were pro-life and understood that there was some kind of an agenda behind the abortion industry to rid the population of black children. And what was it that really occurred in our nation's history that seemed to have reversed the trend totally?
Well, basically, listen, last election, 97% of African Americans voted for the Democratic candidate. Why? Because of their allegiance to the party that they perceived was a facilitator of the civil rights legislation and movement, which is erroneous. But there's other factors, too, that why they perceive that. One, Martin Luther King's father called Kennedy and asked for protection for Martin. People believe John Kennedy was cheering Martin on. John Kennedy and his brother, Robert Kennedy, were begging him to stop. But he would not. But it was Martin Luther King's father actually said, if you would change your position, you would have I promise you 1 million or 2 million votes the next time you run for the presidency. Now, ironically, he never gets that chance. But nevertheless, he began to encourage and push civil rights legislation. I don't want to diminish John Kennedy. I happen to like him. You know, there's a few things, of course, we know are questionable. But the fact of the matter is, he really got incentive when he saw it as a new voting base, plain and simple. And because it's his party that's fighting civil rights legislation, it was the Dixocrats, those the Southern Democrats especially, that were fighting the legislation for civil rights. Well, he did send the protection. I think that was in Alabama as opposed to Georgia, and I can't remember all the details. He did send the protection. He began to write the legislation. Once again, I don't want to make your listeners upset. I thank God, for President Johnson, his vice president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, but he was one of the more racist politicians that there was, but he had sense enough to continue in the same vein. Matter of fact, if you watch Selma, they actually did project him just the way he was. So, sometimes, I don't even like watching certain things because people put their spin on it, their ideology. But even Alveda King was very happy with Selma. She said, to her knowledge and to what the family talked about and to what she knew, Selma was extremely accurate. So, and I do appreciate that. So, here you have this shift. Now, Jesse Jackson kind of sealed it when he himself had political aspirations and had donned himself as the leader. It wasn't really, oh my goodness, Ralph Abernathy. It wasn't Abernathy, or to me it should have been Y.T. Walker, when you begin to read and study, or Fred Shuttlesworth, without question. I would like to really know what happened, how Jesse Jackson became that person. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, as many who like to sell articles and books do, but there's very strong, credible witnesses and persons said that basically Jesse Jackson had become a government person, and if he would do his bidding, that they would assist him media-wise in dawning him as the black leader, being that they would have their thumb on him. So how much of that is true? If you read Serial Killers, you will unquestionably note that their facts are searchable and you can check them out and accurate. I think the greatest testimony to that was Y.T. Walker, when someone asked him, was Jesse Jackson being utilized by the government to basically be an innocent person to try to thwart the efforts of Martin Luther King. He said in Memphis, the night he was killed, there was a government shutdown in Memphis, and nobody could go in or come out travel-wise. You couldn't leave, you couldn't go out. They said there was only one African-American that left Memphis. There's only one person that left Memphis that night and on a plane, and that was Jesse Jackson. So you can pursue that and check all things out. My point is, he gave his soul to the Democratic Party. Well, we're following, and Johnson's signing the legislation, and he's fighting his party, but the face of the party, they can see, which is Johnson and those that, basically tied in with him, is saying that this legislation must go forth, therefore we are the party of the civil rights, which nothing could be further from the truth. So, African-American leadership, and they have gotten their props and their accolades, unfortunately, by being politically engaged. And so, unlike white pastors, Caucasian pastors, who have a tendency to step back from politics, in the African-American community, because of the civil rights era, you, in some way, form, or fashion, have to be engaged. Some way, form, or fashion. They can get away with bringing politicians in and speaking on Sunday and not worry about their 501c3s being snatched because they just choose to challenge them on it. But make it a long story short, because it really, that could be two or three programs. that's, in a sense, what happened. And the African-American community, unlike any other community in the country, when surveys and the data was done, we still revere our pastor as the number one leader of our society, of our community society. There's no other community that views their pastor. The doctor is two, the politician is three. So they've always, one short example that you can ask another question. Okay, just to show you what I mean, Pat Robertson runs for president. What does he do? Well, they'll never elect a pastor. So he defrocks himself. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah,
he defrocks himself so he could be acceptable to who? His community. you'll never have the white vote as a white pastor can't
right.
win. But Jesse Jackson didn't do that.
Right.
As a matter of fact, he would have lost his identity if
right.
he had defrocked himself. And, I'm sure there's people that could probably communicate this far better than me as a basically just as a preacher. But that, nevertheless, sociologically speaking, was the perceptions, and are the perceptions. And right now, who did Obama pay to be one of his mouthpieces? It was a preacher, Al Sharpton. And then he got in Jesse Jackson. Now, ironically, it was those who were outside of religion that chose to call him out, Cornel West, Tavis Smiley. They're not pastors, but to be quite honest with you, and I don't agree with them on everything, they at least challenge the agenda of the president, which I can't think of a pastor on that level of exposure chose to do. You know, and I thank God for E.W. Jackson there, who is beginning to lift his voice, was really beginning to lift his voice down there in the South. But as far as nationally speaking, it should have came from the perceived leadership of the African-American community. The pastors should have really galvanized together and said, even if you were fooled by the agenda of Barack Obama, I don't want to get into, you know, I'm not going to. He could not have done anything more than what he has done these last 8 years. He was always, this was always his agenda. If you study and read his writings and knew the crowd that he affiliated with, this should not have been a surprise. What the surprise is that he was able to do it quite, quite successfully. And continues today to still have a certain degree of a high rating of appreciation, or I forgot what that rating is called, acceptance rate or popular rate. So, which is a sad note for the church that they're now looking for the government to set the sociological and the value agenda instead of stepping up and enforcing our agenda by being visible in the public square.
I'm going to be going to a break right now, and before I go to the break, let me just ask you a question so you could think about it when and answer it when we return. It seems almost miraculous in a negative sense that even though we had primary powerful individuals like Jesse Jackson jumping ship and becoming pro-choice advocates after being militantly pro-life previously, it seems amazing that it's across the board, every prominent African-American that has the spotlight on them, at least, who is a member of the Democratic Party and maybe affiliated more with liberal politics, has seemed to have totally sucked in all of the pro-abortionist propaganda. And it just seems to me utterly breathtakingly amazing that it seems to be, you know, very, very rarely heard voice in the media when you hear an African American speaking up for the pro-life movement. That has changed in recent years, largely due to the Fox network. Now, I'm not a big trumpet player, thinking that Fox network is some kind of a haven of perfection in the media. But they do seem to have quite a number of African Americans who are pro-life featured on that network. But anyway, perhaps you could explain to our listeners why this seems to be such a the pro-abortion position seems to be almost a universally held position of the leadership in the African American community, at least that which we see in the media. And if you'd like to join us on the air with questions of your own, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Clenard Howard Childress.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
Finances and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
And Lynbrook Baptist Church wants to remind everybody that they are having a special Resurrection Sunday service at both the 8:30 a.m. service and 10:45 a.m. service this Sunday, March 27th, and there's going to be a free hot buffet breakfast available from 9:15 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. And for more details, call 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit their website, lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org. And we want to thank Lynbrook Baptist Church of Lynbrook, Long Island, for being a faithful sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio dating back all the way to 2006. Without their generosity, we would likely not be on the air. Thanks to Pastor Bob Walderman, Deacon Sal D'Antona, and the brothers and sisters at Lynbrook Baptist Church, Lynbrook, Long Island. That's lynbrookbaptist.org, lynbrookbaptist.org. If you just tuned us in, our second guest today is Dr. Clennard Howard Childress, and he is the founder of blackgenocide.org, and we are speaking about the mysterious silence of black leadership in the media in regard to the slaughter, the infanticide of unborn black children. And if you could comment why this seems to be such an incredibly and amazingly and breathtakingly disturbing universal position of black leadership that we see, at least in the spotlight in the media. Dr. Childress.
Yes, and first, you know, your listeners ought to know that since Roe versus Wade, over 20 million African Americans have been killed by abortion. Over 20 million. And African Americans make up 12.4% of the population, 36% of the abortions, that's genocide, and that 1,786, according to Alan Guttmacher, which is the research arm, they say they're not, but they are the research arm for Planned Parenthood, 1,786 African American children are killed each day. And so when you have that type of systemic attack on the womb of a specific community, that is the only community that's beneath the replacement level, by the way. You need 2.2 in order to reproduce the existing population that you have, and African Americans are at 1.96. So, and we're the only ethnic group. And believe it or not, it's even worse overseas in Europe with the Italians and in England and France. It's really a global holocaust that is going on, and because it's silent, because it's done behind closed doors, many people don't understand. But that still is the shedding of innocent blood. And certainly, we cannot invoke the favor of God when we have sought to slaughter the innocent. And so, having said that, African American leadership, which had such a strong biblical base in the 60s, with Martin Luther King making comments that the Negro cannot win if he chooses to sacrifice his children for immediate comfort or safety. Now, Roe versus Wade had not even materialized, but he was making comments like this. In the most famous letter ever written in America, as far as I'm concerned, is a letter from a Birmingham jail. Let's say this, the most insightful letter, written while in prison, written a pen and paper smuggled in, and the message smuggled out. he said the early church put an end to such evils as gladiator contest and infanticide. And if you knew the story of both of those incidences that he references in the letter from Birmingham jail, the black church unquestionably should be ashamed of themselves that they could ever pick up the ideology or the mindset that you can destroy life in the womb. Martin's words certainly are more relevant today than they were when he said them. But if the listeners need to know that the early church, during the time of Rome, it was legal for you to have a child. If you didn't like the way the child looked, eyes or whatever, you could leave the child by the side of the road to die by Roman law. The early church rescued those children with the penalty of death hanging over them every day the child was with them. And the early church was so diligent about it, it eradicated the law. And I can tell you right now, there probably were no protests by the church, but just diligence to rescue life. I mean, this is why when you see those by the clinics handing out material, counseling, that's pivotal. That is pivotal. And they are crucial to this turning around. Sometimes we're looking at the White House. God's looking at the little clinic to see who comes out to rescue those children. And the gladiator contest, you say, well, how does that have to do with anything? Well, there was a priest that day, making a long story short, for some reason God told him to go down to the arena. And the Caesar was there, and he saw the battle going on with the soldiers. And one soldier was wounded, and the other one stood over him with his sword. And the name of the priest escapes me. I didn't know I was going to be telling this story. But he rushes out of the stands and stands between the wounded soldier and the soldier with his sword drawn, waiting for Caesar to give the thumbs down. Well, the crowd erupts into laughter. But here's his word: the killing must stop. He never changes. Every time they're jeering him, tell him to get out of here, get out of here, he says, the killing must stop. The killing must stop. Well, he gets the thumbs down from Caesar, from the Caesar of that time. And the sword, he wounds the priest just to get him out of the way. The priest absorbs the wound, repositions himself in front of the soldier and the wounded soldier with only one thing: the killing must stop. Finally, the soldier gets basically frustrated, and he's bringing the sword down on the priest or the clergyman, and he kills him, with the last word sounding out, the killing must stop. Caesar stood up. Silence swept the whole place, and he walked out. When Caesar and his entourage walked out, the stadium emptied out. What did Caesar do when he got back to his palace? He wrote an edict: there'll be no more gladiator contests in Rome. That's a true story.
Wow.
And that's how it ended. So Martin references this in his letter while he's in jail, answering the nine preachers that are telling him to stop going into the public square, stop causing the disturbances, stop protesting. But if that one priest, which was the answer to many people's prayers, don't get me wrong, it just wasn't his effort, he was moved by the prayers of the righteous of Rome, those that were left, that this hideous and barbaric practice would stop. And so he goes down, he's led there, and he stands in between, and he dies there. But the killing stopped. And see, the church doesn't want to stand in between the law, their political party, the establishment that has an unjust law. Augustine, I think it was, who said any law that does not reflect God's law is an unjust law. Abortion is an unjust law. It's up to the righteous to stand between the murderer and the victim and declare the killing must stop. Though both of them were killed that day, the position of the man of God was standing in between attempting to stop.
Now, I have heard from African Americans that are more conservative, not only in their theology, but in their political activism, that the average member in the pew of an African American church or predominantly black church is typically very pro-life, but that it's the leadership and the clergy that are pro-choice or who acquiesce to the liberal agenda on this issue. From your experience, do you agree with that?
To a certain degree, because the key thing, the real litmus test is, are you pro-life enough to have your vote reflect your value? You hear people talk about value voters. That's what they're really basically trying to incite the church. Why are we voting and giving our allegiance to people who are outside our values? Well, people say, well, in the African American community, say, well, the other choice is far too draconian. We can't go. You tell some black people in the urban community that you're or talk about a Republican candidate, you get turned off so fast. It's amazing. It's kind of funny sometimes, but they're looking at, basically, they're listening to propaganda, because, first of all, no one deserves 97% of your vote except Jesus. There's only one candidate. There should have been some variance there, some type of, I mean, that's just absurd. But to make a point, and then for that person to advocate the slaughter of the innocent, the dismembering of children, the only living politician in America that agreed and voted yes actually voted against the Born Alive Victims Act and still be elected president.
And why don't you explain what exactly that is? Because some of our naive listeners might not know how horrific this issue is.
I'm so sorry. But his own state, when he was a state senator, and he also did it as a federal senator, Jill Stanek, a nurse, testified before the committee and before the Senate that children were being born alive and being left to die. I just recently read...
In hospitals.
In hospitals, yes. I just recently read yesterday that they listened to the child scream for an hour and still let the child die. And you listen and say, well, how did that happen? Through a botched abortion. Yes, and the abortion was in a month that the child is unquestionably totally viable.
Yeah, and when John McCain was running against Barack Obama and he brought that up, first of all, I was disgusted by both of them because Barack Obama, actually, his first reaction was to giggle when John McCain brought it up, because he was basically saying that this was a straw man argument, and that the real issue was we have to protect a woman's right to choose and all that kind of thing. But John McCain didn't even explain what he was talking about. He let it die. He let the issue die when he could have hammered that until he got a satisfactory answer, which never would have happened.
And asked him the McCain should have asked him the question on how is that American value,
right?
And describe what they were, what he was voting no against. Well, the law came up where indeed that those children would have to be protected if they survive the abortion. They are there on the table looking for nourishment, care, to be cuddled, to be held. You had to do that.
And just to drive this more. Drive it home more clearly. We're talking about nurses taking living babies who survived a botched abortion attempt, being thrown into shoe boxes or wrapped in cloth and thrown into, or placed, I should say, on the shelves of a storage closet or somewhere else where they just die of starvation.
And people don't believe that.
Right.
But it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we've become so callous. The love of many has waxed cold. Well, Barack Obama is the only elected official to say, if the mother willed the child to die, then the child should die. And so do not protect that child. Let the child die.
Amazing.
Well, and I said to myself, I know this man cannot get elected with this hanging over him. But as you well know, the media guarded him and protected him and never, ever talked about that. Never had a sidebar, never had a story. A 60 Minutes didn't do anything on it.
Surprise, surprise.
So, you know, basically they protected him from many such decisions. And when he went to the church in California, what's his name now? Oh, gosh. Rick Warren.
Right.
Rick Warren, Saddlebrook Church. And he said he believed marriage was between one man and one woman. I'm sitting there with my wife, and I'm saying, how many people in America actually know he's telling a barefaced lie, right? And that if you knew anything about him, he never espoused that. Mm. Never. But when he got on Rick Warren, and for what I hear, that actually gave him a boost in his likability when he came up with that. But he was lying. Now, I think, and this is not disrespectful. I don't believe in disrespecting anybody. But that was a lie. Mm-hmm. And he knew he was lying. And now it just came out recently that his advisors told him, when that question is asked, do not give your position.
Mm.
You must say one man, one woman. He said, you will not get elected.
Mm.
So he got there and he lied, plain and simple. So, but if you folks would have really vetted, they would have known Jeremiah Wright believes that in same-sex marriage, and he believes in a whole lot of other things that certainly America, mainstream conservative Americans would never embrace. And he spent multiple years at that church. He wouldn't have been there fighting against Jeremiah Wright.
Right.
He was his commandant. He was his homeboy, as we would say in the street. So it was an outright lie. And unfortunately, with African Americans, we still feel, bottom line, that this is our only choice, this party, if we ever are going to be upward and mobile.
Mm-hmm.
But That is really a misnomer.
Well, I have a question from Long Island, New York. CJ from Lindenhurst brings up a question that is really right at the heart of what you just said. He says that African Americans I know will say they refuse to switch parties because the Republicans do absolutely nothing about abortion anyway, and since I agree with other important issues that the Democratic platform champions, I'm not going to abandon my party for a party of liars and cowards who do nothing to save the life of the unborn. And I mean, there is some validity in that, but I don't think that it is a thoroughly thought out answer to the problem. But I think you and I both agree, and even Mark Crutcher brought up that the fact of the matter is that the Republicans in leadership have very often betrayed the pro-life believing Christians in their voting base.
There's no question about that. And when that argument comes up, I don't always don't want to make it a political argument, mm-hmm. Even though you have to discuss it sometimes politically, because what they're basically saying is that I will sell my soul because to choose otherwise, I can't trust the individual who's speaking my values. Now, whether they do it or not, you got to just roll the dice on that. If he says, if you're pro-life, I'm pro-life. You for education reform, I'm for education reform. You believe marriage is between one man and one woman, I believe marriage is between one man and one woman. Well, your party doesn't agree with any of those three things. How high on the priority are your priorities? If life is my priority, well, then when I vote, I have to consider that. I can't say, well, and this is what the Democratic Party depends on, this blind allegiance, because why should I change if you don't challenge me to change? Why should I offer services if you accept my candidacy and my office without any without holding me accountable for anything? Why should the Democratic Party look to any way line up with the values of the African American church and the African American is African Americans constituency when there's no demand for them to? And because the other guy is such a bad choice, you always have to come to me. Well, first of all, that's absurd, it's wrong, and we need to send a message to the Democratic Party, you don't own me. As Star Parker would say, I'm not on the plantation any longer. You will not take my vote for granted. And if there's any ethnic group in the country whose vote is totally taken for granted, it is the African American community's vote, and justifiably so, because we do not challenge them to make the necessary changes that our conscience isn't seared every time we choose to support it.
Let me ask you something that is quite controversial, that involves sensitivity and so forth. But there are people, both liberal whites and those in the African American community, who will listen to this program. And they will say, okay, even though we may disagree with Dr. Childress, and we may even consider him an Uncle Tom or a traitor or what have you, he has the right to criticize the black female population for the outrageous number or unbalanced number of abortions that are taking place in the community in compared to white women getting abortions. He may have, we may disagree with him on his pro-life or anti-choice positions, but he has the right to do that. Mark Crutcher, who is white, and Chris Arnzen, and anybody else who is white, you better keep your mouth shut when it comes to things like that, because that is just a reflection of your racism. You know, that is a real phenomenon that exists where if a white person were to address these issues in public, they are deemed to be racist. Where someone like you, an African American, you may be viewed as an Uncle Tom or as just being wrong, but you have more of the freedom to express yourself. How do you respond to that kind of thing?
Well, first, I don't want to ever be perceived as that I'm coming at women, and because that certainly
right.
my adversaries. Fodder, because that's what they try to paint on my social activism. As a matter of fact, I quote Dr. King. He said, where there is darkness, the people will sin. therefore, it's not so much the people that sin, those that have created the darkness. And that's who I go after. Those who have created this darkness, this deception, this delusion, and are targeting and seducing disproportionate amount of African American women to accept abortion as a contraceptive. That is, it is diabolical, and it is achieving their purpose. You're right. Now, I can't change the political correctness. I don't think I have that much power. we have to learn how to operate inside it. I share with my those who work with me. I say, listen, Boardwalk, Park Place, no, Boardwalk, Luxury Tax, Park Place. Anybody who plays Monopoly knows exactly what I'm talking about. If you don't like Boardwalk being there and the luxury tax being after it and then Park Place, well, guess what? You can't play. So you got to be able to roll your dice where you are able to navigate that and get past go and continue. That's the game that you've been given. I say this to my white pro-life advocacy social activists and all those who are engaging the public square. Let's not try to, you know, worry so much about justice when you are just, you know, concerned about a baby, whether it's white or black. But you see how African Americans are being victimized and how foolish it is for to give this allegiance to the party. But right now, you really can't carry that message. Okay? It really takes. And a perfect example is, you may not be aware of it, in Purdue University, and I have to go out there in 3 weeks, in Purdue University, the White Students for Life tried to do what I do with the Black Life Matters. Now, for your listeners that don't know, I have projects where we travel with the Center for Bioethical Reform, who creates these 12x4 pictures. But we basically took certain pictures from things that have happened. Mike Brown, the young man that was choked to death by the police officers, and we grieve with these people, don't get me wrong, and say, well, there's a greater sin. There's a greater genocide going on. And police officers, I don't care if they all did it each day, they would never catch up to abortion.
Right.
But you can't carry that. I can go out there because they have been demonized. They have these aspersions about they already have been given stereotype. We've been stereotyped so strongly what pro-lifers are. And so when they see black men and women behind the All Black Lives Matters project, they are totally baffled. Because these aren't supposed to be pro-lifers. First of all, there's African-Americans. But yet there's white Republicans standing alongside them and working with them. And we close out in prayer, and we have great fellowship, but we carry that message. So we just have to accept that until things change. I'm not going to ever try to change that. I have to, okay, how can I use this to my advantage, God? And he touched me, an African-American preacher, and a white lawyer, Greg Cunningham, almost at the same time. He called me the week after God speaking to me, the saying, Black Lives Matter is a gift to the black pro-life movement. Use it. And you get on these campuses, there's not a kid, white or black, that has not heard Black Lives Matter.
Right.
It cuts right to the problem.
Right. Right.
I don't have to dance around with a whole other issues to get to what I want to talk about. And guess what? If I say Black Lives Matter, they come to attention.
Right.
Because of the political correctness. They try to use it to intimidate politically. I try to use it to educate.
And we are out of time, and it's blackgenocide.org. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Childress, for being on, and I look forward to having you back. I want everybody to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner. We look forward to hearing from you and your own questions tomorrow on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.